Now, I suppose you all know how ordinary television works.
You photograph something.
Sure, I do. You photograph something, then the photograph is split up into millions of tiny pieces, and they go whizzing through the air down to your TV set where they're all put together again in the right order.
You should open your mouth a little wider when you speak.
Hello, everybody. This is Mike TV episode 19, in which we will be discussing AMC's Preacher, now airing in its fourth and final season. And in this episode of Mike TV, we are going to be covering episode 9, the penultimate episode of the series, entitled Overture. My name is Lisa, and joining me is my co-host, Dean. Hello, Dean.
What's up, Lisa? How are you doing today?
I am great. I'm excited to talk about this episode of Preacher, another really good one.
I know, the overture, the beginning to the end.
Yes, and it definitely was that. I'm feeling it. I'm having a lot of feels about this show coming to the finish line.
Yeah, everybody's getting tested. We're finding out some people's true colors in this one and finally seeing some of the final motivations for everyone, except I still have no idea what God's plan is, but maybe that's the point. Maybe none of us really ever do.
I would be pretty sure we're going to find out next episode. You know, some of our predictions that we made last week came true, so we can talk about those as we come on them in the episode. But that was kind of exciting.
Yep.
Some of the things we discussed actually happened, and who would have known that? I definitely, you know, just kind of overall thoughts, loved all the Star Featherstone stuff. That was hysterical, so we'll talk in depth of that. Everything with Hitler again was great. All the Hitler Jesus stuff, so great. And there's a moment in particular that I especially loved. Really enjoyed the Eugene bits that we got.
Yeah, I know we talked about that last week, and I thought it was. So do you think Eugene's done, or you think they'll cut back to him?
I think we should definitely talk about it when we get to it in the scene, but I have some thoughts on it. But it was really, really good, really well done. Quick and tight and got the plot moving. And then, of course, you know, it's all coming together for the big finale, but I definitely loved seeing our main trio back in action. So we had some great action shots with them, some great conversation between those three. I've missed the three of them together.
Well, you only get it for so long.
I know, but it was really nice having them doing their thing. So it was a good episode. All the pieces are definitely in place for the big showdown next week, but we've got to dive into this penultimate episode first. Should we dive right in, or do you have any more overall thoughts?
I say let's get going.
Let's go for it. Okay, so the episode opens with a close-up of Jesse's gross eye hole, and he flips over his new eye patch. So he got an eye patch, don't know how, don't really care, but it was a nice close-up of that gross eye hole. While he's in the bathroom affixing his eye patch, Cassidy and Tulip, they're still, of course, all at this Holy Bar and Grail hotel room. And Cassidy and Tulip are discussing whether or not they should tell Jesse that they slept together. Cassidy is kind of just having a conversation with himself, really, saying, yes, we probably shouldn't tell him. What does it matter? Doesn't matter now. When Jesse walks out of the bathroom, Tulip immediately jumps up and comes clean on all of it. And she does it in such a manner, such a Tulip manner. She even says, look, you can word us into toads or whatever you're going to do, but this is what happened. You were gone and we slept together. And Jesse says, thank you for telling me. And, you know, says, of course, I'm not going to word you into toads. I love you both very much, no matter what. Then they tell Jesse they are going to get Humperdew. And we cut to a Humperdoo grooming scene, and then a great kind of parade while they're bringing Humperdoo through the Grail crowd, who are cheering him on wildly, as right. as if a like a minor mob scene, really. And Featherstone is ushering Humperdoo through all the screaming fans. And the funniest scene is, you know, she's pushing people and knocking people out of the way. But even this old man comes up to Humperdoo and says, "Bless me, Messiah." And Featherstone wastes no time in kicking him right in the gut.
Yeah, it was like, reminded me, it was like the 300 kick, you know, where this is Sparta and kicks him into the pit. Like, it was just a full-on slow motion kick to the chest. It was awesome.
Mm-hmm. So they finally end their long walk of fame into a small gathering room where a welcome party is waiting for Humperdoo. It's all the dignitaries, all the sash people, you know, the higher ups from the Grail, of course, you know, Star is there. And Jesus is there as well. And Humperdoo is very excited to see all of the pastries and the spread that's laid out for him. And he quickly picks up a couple of pink icing cupcakes. And then the funny scene, Jesus comes in to hug Humperdoo, and those cupcakes get smashed on Jesus right as they are now pink icing nipples on yeah. Jesus's robe. And it's pretty evident that Jesus doesn't like seeing Humperdoo in the spotlight. It's very funny. People are approaching him while he's standing there next to Humperdoo and asking him to take a selfie, you know. So Jesus right. is now being removed from the picture and actually designated to picture-taking role. But the big stage production is being set. They're kind of walking through and showing all of the stage setup. It's a big hoopla. They give Humperdoo a pair of gold shoes, which he definitely is oohing over. You could hear over the sound set, they're saying, "Cue the mimes, cue the mimes." It's very funny. It's a big production. But Featherstone eventually takes Humperdoo to his dressing room. And inside that dressing room, God is waiting for him. So we will come back to that. But anything else to say about this opening welcome party for Humperdoo and, of course, the previous brief scene we get at the Holy Grail and bar?
Yeah, Tyson Ritter is doing a great job with Jesus, because you understand that he should be feeling jealous. But at the same time, he does such a good job of, you can tell he as a character is conflicted, because Jesus doesn't mm-hmm. really get jealous, you know, mm-hmm. and so he's hating it, or he's at least feeling the pressure from everywhere, and then the attention's all on Humperdoo. But at the same time, he always has this look like, well, it is Humperdoo, so he deserves it, you know. It's like a good for him type of thing. So it happens a little bit differently, but I kept thinking that like Jesus is getting to the breaking point soon.
Agree. You know, so this really isn't a spoiler, and we've talked about how a lot of this show relates to the comics all along. But so Jesus is not in the comic books.
Oh, really?
So I definitely feel like, well, other than they give the background explanation of Humperdoo, but other than that, he's not in the comics as a recurring character. So I really enjoy the addition of Jesus in this show. I think he brings a lot. I've enjoyed his interactions with Hitler. I think it's just been a really good improvement from the source material, bringing him into, and again, yes, like you said, Tyson Ritter, incredible, just incredible job. and the other thing I was going to say about the comic book is really they're doing, or the comic book and how it compares to the show, is they're really doing more with Humperdoo in the show than they did in the comic book too. Mm-hmm. In the comic book, not really early on, but definitely not all the way to the end. Humperdoo is dead much earlier, and it's because Jesse kills the Allfather, the big fat Allfather, right. by throwing him out of an airplane. And it just coincidentally, the fat bastard lands on Humperdoo. So Jesse inadvertently kills Humperdoo, but right. literally killing two birds with one stone. So that's how it goes down in the comic book. I've really enjoyed the fact that they've made a more major character out of Humperdew, and they've brought in Jesus too. It's been
well. Did they have the clones of Humperdew in the comic?
No.
It was, yeah, and that's just kind of a neat way they kind of maybe subvert your thought too, because they have killed Humperdew so many times, but it's never actually Humperdew.
Right. Yeah. Agree. Okay. So cut back to Holy Grail and Bar. Jesse is standing outside on the dirt road. He's using the word to call God, and then he's mad when God doesn't show. Then they're leaving the Holy Bar and Grail, and Tulip says as they're walking out the door that she really has a good feeling that things are going to really go their way. Always a bad sign. She walks up ahead, and Jesse tells Cassidy, you know, Cassidy asks Jesse, are we good? And Jesse says, yeah, of course. You know, I was in hell, so now I have a new perspective on things. And I was gone, so, you know, I understand. But now I'm back. So he definitely lets Cassidy know he's back, so there'll be no more of those shenanigans with Tulip. The fun touch here as they're exiting their hotel room is the bodies piling up, just like you called it, Dean. Effendi and the demon woman are still fighting. And have been fighting, well, you know, I guess now for
months. Yeah.
And those bodies are in a huge pile outside about to be burned. So that was a great touch.
Did you also notice that the pile he's piling on is already covered? Like, it looked like he already has burned several piles of bodies. So I mean, I guess that's just what this guy is. Well, I guess it's my bar. I better take care of it. That means cleaning up bodies. I got to clean up bodies.
That was probably the daily ratio. That's probably his new daily routine, right? But before our three heroes depart, we do get a neat scene of Effendi and the demon putting their hand on Jesse and saying, be careful with our child. So 100% confirmation there that they are Genesis' parents.
Right.
So good, 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 good. All right. Then another tie-in that we weren't expecting, Dean. We see the morning show crew again. It's Morning America or whatever. And they are just starting their show when that crazy madman from the last time we saw him, he just starts shooting them on live TV. Flash to, oh my gosh, it's that sheriff in Pensacola, that chief in Pensacola, still sitting at his desk watching TV. He's watching this go down. He's remarking about how you just can't trust anything on TV anymore. He says something about this damn TV, but
anything for ratings.
Yeah, anything for ratings. Thank you. Then all of a sudden, the broadcast is taken over. It doesn't matter what channel he flips to; it's now on every channel. Dun da da da! The apocalypse review is beginning. So this is now being broadcast all over the world. This chief, and forgive me, I've already forgotten his name, but he said he knows that's Herr Starr because of the reports he had been getting from Hoover too. So he says, Herr Starr, you know, he knows that this is something with Starr. So this is happening now. And do you think we're going to see this chief of police again? Or do you think that was just a fun little callback to let us see again that this is happening around the world?
I did almost have this kind of thought that there's no way that they would do this unless at this point they're just like, we could do anything. I did have this thought of what if when everything's about to go down, it goes straight like Monty Python, Holy Grail style, where the police just bust in, the Pensacola police bust in and just completely shut down the apocalypse.
No one expects the Pensacola police.
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah, I could dig it. At this point, I'm in for the ride no matter what happens. I'm going to love it, I'm sure. I don't think they can screw it up at this point. They have got the pieces in place, so it's all good. All right, so this apocalypse review, we go from seeing it on this chief of police TV in real life. We see Starr is the MC. He talks about how there's going to be a few opening acts, jugglers and mimes, and even Paula Poundstone, Dean, is gonna
make or did she ever really leave is the question.
That was a funny funny reference. I'm not sure why they chose her, but it was funny. And then she says, but then Star says, when that clock hits zero, cut to a digital timer on the wall that's at 59 minutes. When it hits zero, the Messiah will dance. And so starts the apocalypse. And I love how he says, et cetera, et cetera. And then he says, the righteous will be spared, of course, but the sinners, woo! Today is the day they get theirs.
Yeah.
So, yeah, it started with only 59 minutes to go.
Yeah, this is where we also get that cool, like as he's saying the sinners, and he kind of says a couple groups of people. And I can't remember what he says.
Oh yeah,
he says the three feminists. Categories. Yeah, the feminist and Tulip jumps down, and he says something. And Cash jumps down, yes, and he says desperados. And
yes, they're infiltrating Masada as he's doing this, yep, because they're all gathered in one spot, so it's pretty easy for them to get into Masada at this point. But yeah, he does say he says the feminists. Tulip drops in the degenerates. Cassidy drops in, and the desperados, and then Jesse. Great titles for all, yep, three of them.
Yeah, absolutely.
As if there's anything wrong with being any of those things. anyway, so cut to back to Humperdew's dressing room. We're once again on the tail end of another story, and this time we know God is telling Humperdew his story of Cain and Abel, and in a very funny scene, Jesus knocks on the door and God refuses to open the door for him, right, which is awful. It's heartbreaking, really. Poor little Jesus's face. God is just speaking to him through like a little viewfinder in the door. So it's not a peephole. It's like a slider little, yeah, door where you can only see like someone's maybe eyes and nose through it. So God is speaking to him through this viewfinder. And here's Jesus. And he's got a dozen roses in his hand. And he's like, I wanted to congratulate you on your big day and wish you well. And I brought flowers for Humperdew. And, you know, he's just there to be a good guy. And God just is like, thanks, and won't open the door. So then Jesus tries to push the flowers through the little viewfinder, which doesn't work. All the buds fall off of it. And God is, you know, accepting just basically stems now. But he is still saying, all right, we're very busy, is that all? He's, you know, still refusing to open the door. And Jesus says, wait, just one more thing. And we see behind Jesus, there's Hitler with the beatbox. He hits play, It's Tricky starts coming out, and Jesus starts another dance. I loved that we got another callback to this. The whole time Jesus is doing this dance again for God, and God is just watching it through the viewfinder. And when Jesus is done, all God says is good and closes the door, closes the window.
Yeah, so it was definitely a you know how parents will do that with their kids, especially when they're doing one thing with their favorite and the other one comes, oh yeah, great, dad look at me, yeah. Nice, you're doing good, kid.
Pretty sad though. But yes, God's focus is 100% on Humperdew, which this is where we really see God breaks bad in this episode, okay? Because he goes back in, and I should have mentioned there was a lady in there who's doing Humperdew's hair and getting him ready, and she's combing Humperdew's hair when God walks back in, and Humperdew kind of whines in pain because, I mean, his hair is a total rat's nest, so of course it's going to hurt being combed out.
Right.
But God hears Humperdew in pain and without haste just slams that lady into the wall. So God's got this power now where he can just whoosh his hands and a person will go flying, and this person was now embedded into the wall, dead. Now, here we are, Dean. I know you thought it when you saw it, too. So I'm going to say it. Here's our obligatory Legion call out. Because as soon as God did that, I said, oh, God just pulled a page from David Haller's book.
Yeah. What even reminded me of my thought of Legion from that. Well, yeah, because he did that to several people. But
yeah,
if you remember even the very first episode of Legion, like of the whole series, really the first big mutant power reveal is at the end when they break him out of Clockworks, and that one mutant that's with them has that power where he can throw people, and like he throws a big boulder at somebody. So it had that same unexpected effect when he did it the first time I saw it on Legion. So there we go.
So I think God watched Legion, or definitely the people who wrote Preacher were into it. There's been too many parallels to go unnoticed. Anyway, then we get a great montage. You know, nobody does a montage like Preacher. They're always really cleverly assembled, visually interesting. This time it's with a bunch of different sized square shapes and rectangles of imagery of Tulip and Cassidy and Jesse just badass fighting their way through the Grail, right? It's just great, great fight scenes. Go Tell It on the Mountain is a religious song. This upbeat religious song, Go Tell It on the Mountain, is playing behind them as this is happening.
I thought it was a great way, because we talked about that where I said I thought at some point we're going to have a real long battle scene. But this was a good way to show you that was happening. But let's go ahead and take it, 25 seconds and do it instead and have more time for everything else. So it was a nice way to still get the cool fight, but just fast forward it real quick.
Yeah. And showing so many scenes at once in the different squares was interesting, because you could see it from all different points of view, and you could tell they were having just the time of their life. I mean, it was just a great fight. They were all three of them just completely kicking ass and having a blast.
Yeah.
Never once did Jesse use the word. Didn't need to, right? They were just having a good old-fashioned throwdown.
Yep.
All right. So we will. So as they have finished what seems to be the bulk of the battle, we see them kind of walking through, continuing to work their way through Masada. Cassidy's a little bit further up ahead, and so Jesse takes that time to remind Tulip that, remember, no matter what Cassidy says, this is not a rescue mission. So, meaning Jesse and Tulip obviously do not plan to rescue Humperdoo the way Cassidy does. Then they walk into this great scene, kind of, we've seen it, it's in like the opening credits, right, where they all three kind of walk in together. So we see that scene finally, and they are in, I guess, the bottom floor of Masada. It was like this arena style that went really high up, and they're saying, where is everybody? And Jesse says they're up there and points up, and it goes very high up. And I guess we're to believe that the crowd is somehow elevated several floors above them, waiting for this apocalypse review, right?
Yeah, I thought maybe that because they're in like a theater, so I didn't know if maybe that would be where that glass window is. If you were in the theater, maybe like that was the top of the stands, and like above the last row up at the top, maybe there's a big window up there. So I don't know.
It wasn't real clear. The design of that structure was not very clear. But anyway, they know they've got to go up to get where they need to go. So I guess that's all we really need to know. But then they turn around and Cassidy is gone.
Yeah.
So we will come back to that. We get a just wonderful scene. Maybe took a little too much time, but I don't care. I loved it. Eugene is in jail. He's got his guitar that he got last episode, and he's singing Closing Time and practicing that on the guitar. There is a rude asshole minister, and I say rude asshole minister because this guy was just such a dick to him, but he's sitting next to Eugene, and Eugene is saying to him, I'm going to be getting out today. He makes a mention about how they didn't find just the preacher's remains in his waist. So like they thought the whole reason he was arrested is because they never found a body. They knew he confessed to killing Jesse. They never found a body. And remember a few episodes back when Tulip and Cassidy were interrogating him, or when Tulip was interrogating him, there's a police chief in there that tells Cassidy that they thought he ate
him.
He ate him. So I liked the call back there that Eugene's like, okay, they're setting me free. They realize now I didn't eat him. And, you know, he's saying to this minister, what do you think God's plan is for me? And I don't really have verbatim, but that minister is just basically just calling Eugene, you know, like a defective person and saying, yeah, you know, clearly God has no plans for someone like you. But Eugene, ever the optimistic, concludes from that conversation that, yes, that must mean he is meant to be a rock star.
Rock star.
So that's his takeaway from that conversation. Meanwhile, I forgot that I didn't write this down either. I don't know if you caught it, but there was another funny Australian intercom bit going on in that jail during this exchange.
Yeah, no, I was hoping about, maybe you wrote it. I didn't.
Oh, I meant to go back. It was something like, you know, because it's like this is like a polite jail,
right? Yeah.
And it was just like with last week's, it was something about the pedophiles. The dispensary is now open. Mm-hmm. This time it was like, murderers, please don't do that, or something like that. It was like a public service announcement. It was very funny. Okay, cut back to Tulip and Jesse. They're looking around for Cassidy, but can't find him. Finally, Tulip just says, forget him, and they go on. And then we see from behind a wall, so they clearly didn't look very hard, God has captured Cassidy and is holding his hand over his mouth, so, you know, they could not hear or find Cassidy. But Cassidy has heard them say and heard Tulip say, forget it, forget him. So that's not good. That can't be good for Cassidy, nor what happens in the following scenes are they good for Cassidy. But anyway, God has Cassidy. He starts tempting him with all of his deepest desires, like, hey, I'll give you a mountain of heroin. and even all the way up to you having your life fully restored and being back in Ireland with your family. We get a what-if scene reunion of Cassidy and Billy returning home from the war. Cassidy's right. Human. You know, so it's an imagination of, you know, what everything God is telling him he could have. He tells Cassidy, you know, you could have a second chance of that life you could have had. And if it weren't for Jesse Custer, that smug son of a bitch, the woman you could have had, all you have to do is one little thing. So we don't learn what that thing is. We cut away from that scene. And we cut to, before we go on, anything about God, this? Yeah.
Very, Satan-like of God.
Yeah.
The way he keeps doing the temptations and it's, I don't know. It's very weird.
Yeah. Not cool, God. Not cool. not my God. So, yeah.
Hashtag.
Yeah. My God. Clearly this is comic book God, of course, yep, we're talking about. All right. So, Tulip and Jesse are heading up on the elevator, and as Tulip is reassuring Jesse that everything will be okay, Cassidy can take care of himself, the elevator breaks down. Jesse says, that's God. He knows it's God that's broken the elevator down. Then in a great moment, another just great acting moment from Dominic Cooper, he gives this very soft speech about how when he was in the presence of God after God resurrected him, he never even once thought to use his power to try to stop God. Even when God was biting into his flesh, he never once thought to use it. It's this kind of quiet, reflective moment that lets us know, really, when you and I were talking about, like, why didn't Jesse ever try to use the Genesis word? You know, why did he ever try to do it? So I like that the writers took that care to give us that inner thought process of Jesse, you know, and it was done really well. Tulip cuts him off, however, and says she read the letter, you know, and he's like, oh, and she says, yeah, what does perpetuity mean? And he explains that perpetuity means forever. Then she says, well, I wish I hadn't, but I burned it. And, you know, she gives him that little synopsis about how she burned it in the church. And then they realize that there's nothing else that can be done. So he hoists her up and she begins to climb the elevator shaft while he stays behind. Any more thoughts about this elevator scene?
I think that might be the most you get about the letter.
Yeah, that's it. That's probably it for the letter. All right, we're going to cut to the star of my favorite scenes, which are Star and Featherstone. So Hare Star is telling Featherstone how pleased he is. The night is going so well, and she should take a break and enjoy it. Now, I should mention that in this scene, we're only seeing them both kind of talking to each other face to face from the shoulders up, yeah. And that's going to be important. So they have this great exchange. Featherstone is saying, I guess this is not really the part where they're talking about how it's all going to end. This is I guess she's just saying, oh, how generous of you, you know, he's saying, you should take a break and enjoy it. And she's like, whoa, how generous of you.
Yeah. And then he says that God's on security tonight or something like
that. Yes, that's yeah. Right. And then her face is all you see is her face, shoulders up. And it's kind of like they're seeing each other for the first time. And do you believe in magic in a young girl's heart is playing and suddenly starts playing. And you can kind of see this swelling look in Featherstone's face as she is just starting to think of Star romantically, perhaps. And then Star says, Featherstone, you're a handsome woman. And after all, I am a handsome man. And she's, of course, agreeing with him. And then finally the camera pans down and in a hilarious fashion, he has been feeling her boobs this whole time. I don't know what else to really make of this scene except for just the pure hilarity and, of course, what it leads to. But finally, he's seen Featherstone for something. But it's funny that he remarks to her as being a handsome woman.
Well, and I think even when he refers to himself, he goes, and I, after all, am a very handsome man. Like, he even, like, props himself up more than even her.
Yeah. So, more to come on that. Back to Cassidy and God. Cassidy is refusing God's request. We do learn what his request is that God wants Cassidy to keep Humperdue safe until the world is destroyed. And Cassidy is just refusing. He is, pretty much asking God why he wants to even destroy the world. And there's so many things that God has already done that are imperfected or imperfection. Like, why can't dogs eat chocolate? You know, and he cites some other things. And I really was shocked at this moment that he didn't bring up the Big Lebowski. I thought we would get another Big Lebowski beat in this conversation.
Yeah. I think he says Tesla's design is stupid. And then when is this when he's also saying, hey, humans have done some good things like Italian food.
Yes. So it's a great exchange. God tries everything. He tries making Cassidy mad throughout this exchange, and then he's actually making him sad. And before we cut away, Cassidy is crying. Back to Star and Featherstone. Now they are in bed. Star is clearly naked, not really covered up. Featherstone has the covers pulled up to right below her chin. Can't see anything. She is saying to him, oh no, Star is saying that they enjoyed that. She says he certainly was ready. And then she says, you know, they still have time to fit in another session. Very strange conversation about the sex they just had, that she refers to it as they could fit in another session before the apocalypse. He calls her a greedy Gus and explains that, or says, you know, that will have to wait until after the apocalypse. And she says, but sir, after the apocalypse, we're going to be in heaven. We won't be able to do that again. And he says, oh, no. There's a new plan. We're not doing total annihilation. We're doing limited annihilation. And throughout this conversation, she says, well, I wasn't aware of that plan. And he says, yeah. The new plans, they were deployed. I sent them out with Hoover too. And then both of the realization on their faces is that the plans never got right to where they needed to go, wherever that is, because Featherstone, of course, killed Hoover too.
Right.
So they now know that the wrong plans are in the hands of the Apocalypse people. And so total annihilation is still the plan. So Star jumps out of bed, frantically getting dressed, telling, you know, he's going to go try to fix this. He is telling Featherstone, clean yourself up. Don't touch my bidet. You know, he's giving her all these instructions. Now, when she jumps up, oh, I should have mentioned, before they jump out of bed, as they're talking about this total annihilation, partial annihilation, that she sits up in bed and it's revealed that she is fully clothed, still in her Grail uniform. So that was hilarious, but don't worry, it's even going to get funnier. So when they're out of bed, Star's getting dressed, Featherstone still, of course, fully clothed. He's telling her, clean herself up, don't touch his bidet. She asks him, sir, why join the Grail in the first place?
Violence.
Yeah.
Power. Mm-hmm. Dirty sex.
Mm-hmm. Which, yeah, you do a good impression of Pip Torrens and Hairstar. Yeah, the dirty sex. And then he says, which, of course, you know something about, Flufferman. And then says, you really think someone like you is getting into heaven? And just laughs and walks away from her, leaving her just kind of crestfallen. But then as the camera pans down, the reveal is that a ginormous fist dildo is affixed to her crotch, her fully clothed crotch. So this is the session that she had been referring to. Now we know fully what just went on between her and Hairstar.
I don't know if it's just because he plays it so straight and then also the conversations that they have, but I in no way saw that coming.
No.
Because I even though that we even talked last week about his proclivities, I think, and and I didn't even think about that. When she was fully clothed, I just thought maybe he just – I didn't know what to think. And I didn't even see, and then as soon as it happened, I was like, oh yeah, that's right.
Yeah. It was a great reveal. Completely didn't see it coming either. Loved it. When she was dressed, I thought it was, well, she's just super, super modest. You know, yeah. I don't know. Who knows? He was already feeling her boobs. So right. I mean, you know, why not take it a step further and take off the shirt, but you know, whatever. It was hilarious. It was absolutely great. I wonder. So we did talk last week in some of our predictions of, will we ever see the love of Featherstone and Star, you know, come to it or reach its climax? And I would say yes, that we did. We saw
it. Yeah. And I feel like we mentioned too, or at least I thought if we didn't mention, I was thinking about it. Hold on. They're about to make an announcement in my office. Oh, there it is. Sorry. Hey, behind the scenes, right. I'm recording from my place of work, which is a public school building.
Yes.
I think we mentioned that we also thought that even if they do hook up, there would be a break between them, as far as I think it was starting to be seen that Featherstone would eventually kind of see past Star. Even we saw that when he was trying to kill her with number two, she seemed to come back in his good graces, but now I think she's finally realizing that what she always thought he was and what she always was obsessed and idolized about him is in no way true.
Well, yeah, knowing that she wasn't privy to this plan of his, this great mastermind plan, that he really just wanted power and money and control and dirty sex. He really didn't really want to die for the cause and ascend to heaven, which has been her mission and her plan all along in bringing about the apocalypse.
Right.
She's ready. She's ready to go to heaven. So yeah, that really, and we'll talk about Featherstone again when we get to the final scenes, but that could have been an awakening for her, right?
Yeah.
Hopefully. All right. Coming back to that. So we get another wonderful scene, as if the dildo reveal scene wasn't great enough. Cut to Hitler and Jesus, my favorite duo. The two who need each other more than ever, Hitler mm-hmm. and Jesus. They are talking, they're having a drink. I think they're back in the conference room where they were having their, you know, their conference discussions. And they're having a drink. Jesus is quite sad over God's rejection. There's a great line where he thanks Hitler for always believing in him the whole time. It says, like, straight up, thank you, Hitler. You've believed in me the whole time. It was very funny. And then Hitler is like, you know what has to be done here, right? And they're kind of giving each other the side eye. And Jesus says, no, you know, I'm not a murderer. And Hitler says, no, 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 of course not, no. But I am.
Right.
And so that is how that scene ends. And at this point, I thought, well, they're talking about Humperdinck, right? And of course, we learn later that they definitely are. But love that, just that punctuation from Hitler, from Noah Taylor plays.
Yes.
Yep. Such a great job where he just goes, he's like gently coercing Jesus into agreeing to let him do the murder,
right?
You know, and so he's just winning Jesus over, and he's just, oh no, 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 Jesus, of course you're not a murderer, I am. Yeah. You know, he's almost got him convinced here, you would think, too. Mm-hmm. Right? Pretty convincing. All right, back to, there's a quick scene where Tulip finally gets to the end of that elevator shaft, and who is waiting for her at the top of her long climb? Of course, God. So it cuts away from that, but I've just kind of continued that scene here where God enters a Grail office, a little small kind of out-of-the-way office, and he says, yeah, yeah, this will do. And he finds a Grail man hiding in there in the dark. And the man is saying, I don't want to die. I don't want to die. I don't know what he thinks hiding in a little office is going to do. But God immediately, again, picks up his David Holler move and slams that man into the wall, too. So another one dead on God's hands. He brings Tulip in there. She's, of course, being her rebellious self. But he threatens Jesse's life. He says, have you ever seen what happens when somebody falls in an elevator shaft? And so he forces her to sit and cooperate and have a conversation with him. So she comes in, she sits down, and she finally is like, look, what do you want? And he says, I want to fight. So cut away from that, back to Jesse in the elevator. He starts using the word to call for help. And we see outside, all around Masada, is just a bunch of birds flying around. I guess that is to let us know no one's coming to help him. Is that what that was for?
No. Okay. So I don't think that was Masada. I think it was Australia. And I think the birds were the crows that always represent the saint. So I think he was calling the saint.
Oh, Dean, you're so wise with these.
Because it even makes sure it shows that, like, his voice is reverberating out there. Mm-hmm. So I think it's his way of, he knows that, we remember that was been our debate, is does he know that he can call the saint? Mm-hmm. I think we realized he does. So that was him calling the saint.
Good, good one. That's exactly what it was. Precisely. Back to Tulip and God. Tulip says she's not interested in fighting God. In fact, her exact words are, nah, I'm good. And he says, no, no, people like you don't change. Not really. She says, you know what, God, I no longer care what you think. And then he pulls out a 60-second timer and says, you know what, I bet I can make you. He says, let's make a bet. I bet I can make you hit me in under 60 seconds. And she's like, nah, you can't. And he says, look, if I win, I'll leave you guys alone. I'll even call off the apocalypse. So clearly that's a bet she cannot refuse. So she says, what's the catch? And he says, well, the catch is you'll screw up like you always do. So he starts the timer and he sits down and they're face to face and he starts to insult her. He calls her a murderer, a cheat, a liar, a whore. And she is resistant and resilient and unaffected. We're about 30 seconds in at this point. God's telling her she's doing a good job. She might actually win this thing. Then he starts to talk about Dallas. And you can see that's getting a rise out of her. And then he says, "You want to know the cosmic sweeping reason for the death of your daughter back in Dallas?" She's still silent. There's this long, dramatic pause, and he's waiting for her to respond. She says nothing. The seconds are winding down, and he says, I can't remember. So he's very flippant about this, at which point she jumps up, has a gun in her pocket, which she pulls out and shoots him several times in the face, which, of course, he is unaffected by. And then the timer goes off. So she was seconds away, but he did it. He got her to react. Now, she didn't exactly hit him. Doesn't matter. I doubt God was even going to keep his word anyway.
Probably not.
Upon the unaffected results of being shot in the face, he immediately punches her out cold. So she's down on the floor. And then we see him grab a trash can, empty all of the contents out of the trash can. And then we see him grab a pair of scissors. And then off screen, we can hear him hacking away and blood is squirting everywhere.
Right.
So, of course, that is a little trickery there to make us think that he's doing that to Tulip. So more to come on that.
Yeah, especially once we find out what he did to Cassidy, then you think, oh, my gosh.
Mm-hmm. Right. So Jesse is somehow out of the elevator shaft now. Or does the elevator start to move?
No, it moves and it opens. Yeah, because God allows it to go.
That's right. So the elevator moves and opens. Jesse walks out. He's back in the spot where he started. And he finds a just ripped to shred. I mean, I can't even really describe this. This is Cassidy's head with his viscerally exposed guts and heart and, you know, and then all of his limbs, everything is just torn from limb to limb, but all kind of there in a bloody pile. However, his head and brain are still intact, so he's able to talk to Jesse. He's crying, and Jesse finds him, and he says, I'm going to get some blood. I'm going to help you. And Cassidy's saying, no, there's no time. There's no time. And he's like, he's saying, I held out. I didn't give in to God's commands. He promised me so much. He promised me he could send me home. Over and over, I said no. And Jesse is just full of concern for his friend and leaning over him as Cassidy is telling him this. And he's saying, I said no and no over. I said no over and over until I said yes. And then all of a sudden, immediately behind Jesse is God. He knocks Jesse out cold. He tells Cassidy, good job. And Cassidy is still crying in this heap on the floor and says, I didn't do it for you. I did it for Hump. I love that he calls Hump or do Hump. Mm-hmm. And then God feeds him a bucket of blood.
You think technically he kicked him out cold since he used Cassidy's leg?
Oh, that's right. That's right. I didn't have that in my notes. Yes, he's picked up Cassidy's severed leg, and that's what he uses to knock out Jesse. Oh, that was a great touch. Great touch. Back to Eugene. He's out of jail now, Dean. And guess what? His rock star career is about to begin, like all rock star careers begin, singing on the street corner.
Yeah, and he picked one of the two songs that they all start with, either Closing Time or Wonderwall. So it's...
He's on the street corner. He opens up his guitar case. He even throws a few token coins in to get the money rolling. He straps the guitar over his shoulder. He has all these visions flash before him, before his eyes, of rock star life and everything that it entails. All the babes, all the drugs, all the flashing lights, all the glitz, all the glamour. He's ready, doggone it. He is ready for this life. So just as he starts to sing Closing Time, a taxi comes flying in from around the curb and runs him down. And then all we see, we hear people screaming, pedestrians screaming, and all we see is this taxi cab with Eugene's legs out from under it. So this is, we talked about this at the beginning when we mentioned Eugene. Do you think he's dead here?
They show his leg twitch, which usually is a way to say that he's, you know, he's at least not dead yet. So I assume that they're going to show him again, but.
Could this be, Dean? Could this be? He's in Australia, this land where even in prison, they've been relatively polite to him. Could this be that now he's been run over by a, you know, a city taxi cab? So maybe there's some city money to put behind this. Will he get a reconstructive surgery as a result of this injury that he has inflicted? And will we see a final scene next week of him actually getting that dream, that rock star dream, and now also fully restored with his looks?
I wouldn't like that. I like the idea that he, even if he was dead at this point, I think what they've done, if that's how they ended it, it would be a perfect wink to the comic readers who were waiting for that ending to happen. And it's like right before it's about to happen, bam, out. No, just kidding. But here's my theory.
Okay.
He dies and then somehow he ends up either in heaven and hell, and that's going to play some kind of end role.
Yes, where he gets to take over one or the other.
Maybe he sits in God's throne.
Mm-hmm. We talked about that. Could Eugene be the one who is pure-hearted enough, I guess, to be able to ascend to that? I don't see him going back to hell. I really don't.
Yeah.
That's good. I like that.
Well, because he only went to hell because he was sent there.
That's true. But now he's also shot Jesse, so he did do something worthy of sending him to hell, but
yeah, I don't know either.
I will be fine if that's the last we see of Eugene and that's it. I'll be fine with that, but I'll also be fine with either of these two scenarios we've just created or even a third one. I guess I'd be fine if that's the last we see of Eugene, but I would like to think we're still going to get a little Eugene coda next week.
Yeah, probably.
Okay, so Jesse, when did I have Jesse back with God?
Because he's back and he just like wakes up in the church.
Oh, that's right. Okay, so Jesse wakes up. He's in the church. Thank you, Dean. And sees God. And I think this is where, even on my second watch, my notes taper off because I was so into it here at the end. And so he wakes up, he asks God what he wants. He says, you know, you've already taken everything. You've taken my family, my child, my eye. You know, what else do you want? And God says he wants Genesis. Mm-hmm. Well, of course he does. I mean, duh. It seems kind of obvious now in hindsight, now that he's actually said the words, like this is what God has wanted. He says that Genesis was never meant to be. It's a stain, a blasphemous stain. And then Jesse says, oh, it's a power to rival your own. And God says, you think so? Why don't you give it a try? Try it, Jesse. Go on, try it. And Jesse, still in his reverence for God, can't do it. And then God commands him. God uses his own commanding voice and says, do it. And Jesse still won't do it. So then God starts picking up Jesse and throwing him across the room too, and just basically beating him some more and still taunting Jesse to use the word on him. Jesse thinks about it, but in the end still doesn't. And God says, you fear me, as you should, and then throws Jesse across the room again.
Yeah, I liked how Jesse was able to resist the word of God. And I wonder if that's because he has Genesis in him.
Yeah. That makes sense.
God has a really great line in this scene too, where he says, and I don't remember it verbatim, but he tells Jesse, like, look at that. The theater's full and the church is empty. Then he says, like, either isn't that how it always is or something like that. But just the fact that nobody's in church praying for the apocalypse, they're all out celebrating the apocalypse.
Yeah. Yeah. God is not happy with humanity at all. I still wonder if we're going to see more of his third creation, but he is totally done. And for some reason, Jesse is at the crux of it.
Yes.
So, all right, cut to Tulip. Okay, she's locked in that same office, but she's alive. We pan over, we see it was the man in the wall, of course. That man, that grail, that scaredy cat grail man that God threw in the wall. That's who he got the blood from, of course. He left Tulip there totally fine. So she has, I love this, because we already know how crafty Tulip is, and she can pick any lock and, you know, hotwire any car. So, of course, she has this elaborate lock pick kit on her person that she pulls out and tries everything she can to pick that lock, but to no avail. So then we move into our final scenes. This is everybody totally in place for the ultimate finale, right? Starts with Hitler loads his gun and heads off to Humperdew's dressing room. Outside of the dressing room, Jesus stops him and says, "You know what? Why do you even care who the Messiah is? You're in hell. What's to you?" And Hitler says, "You're right. I want to win. And I can do a better job at winning that if you're the Messiah instead of Humperdew." So he basically undermines Jesus completely. Yeah. Lets him know, I have no chance against Humperdew, but I can beat Jesus. And Jesus says, "I'm not going to let you murder anyone." And they immediately start a huge brawl. And they are fighting. It does go off screen, but it starts off with just fisticuffs, right? I love that.
It's kind of like a wussy fight too, which I love that they both aren't really physical fighters.
I loved it. So I like that that's where we leave them. I don't know if next week we'll pick up with them still fighting or what the conclusion of that fight is. But, you know, finally Jesus is starting to turn away from Hitler's charms.
Right.
And Jesus is taking a stand, and no matter how jealous he is of Humperdew, he's still not going to let Hitler murder him. So I do like that. Then a hilarious scene. Star is on the phone, is at a fax machine, you know, because when you have important documents, faxing, of course, is the way to go.
Yeah.
But he's trying to fax the correct apocalypse plans to whoever's on the receiving end, but the fax won't go through. So the scene we see is he's on the phone with tech support. We all know how helpful tech support is. Well, Star is frantic and he's fighting with them, and tech support is just telling him the same thing over and over again, that he needs to hit function, start, and send. And that is clearly not working. So that's in place. Then Tulip, just as she is about to, from her prison office, just as she's about to try to knock the door down with a chair, which is clearly not going to work, the door flies
open. She shoots it like three times, and that doesn't open the door. And then, she thinks the chair is going to break it down.
Yeah, the chair, not going to work. Then the door flies open, and it is Featherstone outside. Now, of course, she's holding a gun up. But they are now face to face, and we did talk. About this? Are we going to get another? Did we talk about this in our predictions? Are we going to get another Featherstone Tulip fight scene? And I definitely think that's where this scene is leaving us, because that's the last we see of those two. But based on what we talked about, Dean, maybe this is Featherstone having a change of heart and actually freeing Tulip and taking her side.
Could we see that? That look on her face, you can tell she either was crying or on the verge of crying. So I definitely think that she's going to put her feelings for Tulip aside to do the right thing.
Yeah, she's definitely torn. So let's hope Featherstone steps up and does the right thing. I would like that very much. We shall see. A quick scene with Cassidy now in the dressing room with Hump. And he's just sitting on the couch while Humperdew is now wearing his gold shoes and doing a little practice dance and very proud of himself, saying, "Humperdew, Humperdew," very proud. And Cassidy's watching and saying, "Yes, good job, Hump." And he's saying very sadly that he can't wait. So that's where those two are. So back to Jesse and God. God has sufficiently beat Jesse up, and Jesse says, you know, asks God why he even has Genesis in the first place. Why did Genesis choose him and come to him? And God's response, which was hysterical, is, "God only knows." So, you know, a non-answer answer. And then God says, give it to me, and then commands him again, give it to me. And Jesse's defeated at this point and says, oh, just go ahead and take it. And then when God continues to say, give it to me, Jesse gets defiant and says, my ass, you want it so bad, reach in and take it, you son of a bitch. Mm-hmm. And the room starts to shake, and they look up, and in walks the saint. So good call on that is exactly who Jesse was calling earlier. Perfect. God looks at Jesse and says, what did you do? And then God leaves Jesse's side and stands up, and he and the saint are face to face, kind of staring each other down from across this church. And God says, yes, we do know each other. We go way back. Isn't that right, William? And he begins taunting the saint. And we see these flashback scenes that are kind of interwoven with the current scenes. Really cleverly done. Just enough to remind viewers, if anybody forgot, why the saint is pissed off at God in the first place. Mm-hmm. So, you know, we see his family was murdered and he came back to find them being eaten by crows. It's we see his daughter's doll, the toy, is in the bed with his daughter when she's being eaten by crows. And then again, that doll is in God's pocket. And the saint cocks his gun and holds it at God. And Jesse is telling the saint, what are you waiting for? Do it. Shoot him, do it. And then in this very strange, odd turn of events, God walks back over to Jesse, or starts to approach the saint, turns back, looks at Jesse and says, he's not here for me, preacher. He's here for you. And that is where we leave the episode. God walks off.
All right, I think I can walk. I think you might have missed something in the last scene. Uh-oh. All right, so he's in the field because he says, yeah, we know each other. We go way back. Mm-hmm. And when he's in the field, it shows the saint first his face. He turns. Oh, that's from when he was watching them bury Jesse in Australia. Because you see them in the distance, and then it zooms back on his face where he was watching them bury Jesse at the very beginning of a couple mm-hmm. episodes ago. Mm-hmm. And so he turns, and that's when he sees God in the field. And the flashbacks are because he's starting to think about his daughter and stuff as he's holding the gun on him.
Right.
And then God pulls out the doll. And then the next time we see the doll, it's in the saint's pocket. Jesse, he looks at it, and it's in the saint's pocket. So I think he knew this was going to happen, which is what God is showing that he does anyway. He already met with the saint, and I think probably the same way he did with Cassidy, offered him his daughter back and his family back so that he would fight Jesse or take out Jesse.
Hmm. So it's obvious now that God cannot destroy Jesse on his own. Right. And it's the Genesis entity that is preventing that. Good thought here. God needs the saint to intervene. It does seem strange to me. No matter what, the saint has had so much hatred for God for hundreds of years. It just seems odd that no matter what false promises God gives him, and I say they're false because I just believe that God's not telling the truth at any turn, this iteration of God. I don't know. I find it hard to believe that the saint would believe him or fall for his shenanigans. I don't know. I thought it was weird. I think
the same way I wouldn't think Cassidy would, but he did.
Yeah. Thank God, man. He's power of persuasion, I guess.
Goddamn.
I don't know. I don't think so. The trailer. So let's move on to the trailer a little bit. They don't show us much in the trailer, just kind of everybody just kind of running around like crazy fools. But we do hear there's a couple words from the saint to Jesse saying that we have unfinished business. Mm-hmm. And then we also get a shot of God taking off on a motorcycle, like getting the hell out of Dodge. Now, I'm sure that's those scenes are meant to lead us astray. I don't believe God is going to escape. I really don't.
They did show one quick flash of Jesse and the saint, like, fighting in the church.
Yeah.
So they are at least going to fight.
So they're going to fight, but eventually they're going to have to get back on the same page. That's one episode to do it, Dean. How are they going to do it?
Either that or Jesse's going to kill the saint. Or find a way to kill him or something and do something.
I don't know. I have no predictions on how this could all go down next week. I really, truly don't. I'm loving it. I'm excited. I can't wait. I'm sad. I don't want it to end. But I really cannot see how. We've got a faulty fax machine.
Yeah.
We've got the Jesus and Hitler fighting. Humperdew in the dressing room being protected by Cassidy. Featherstone and Tulip possibly teaming up. Oh, there was also some scenes in the trailer of Tulip and Cassidy fighting. So Tulip does get to Cassidy.
Oh, yeah.
And presumably trying to kill Featherstone, and Cassidy is trying to stop her. So it looks like they're
killing Humperdew.
Yeah, I'm sorry, kill Humperdew. Yeah. So it looks like they're going to fight, and Cassidy's going to continue. He would fight and harm Tulip over for Humperdew? I mean, that's just...
I'm thinking he's probably going to try to talk her out of killing Humperdew because he knows that's what she wants to do, and she's going to, the same way she did at the house or the cabin when she put an axe in his chest.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he's just, it's going to be more of her fighting him and him kind of trying to subdue, not necessarily hurt her.
And I like how Humperdew's dance at this, you know, this countdown is the event that brings on the apocalypse. So somehow stopping Humperdew is the key to stopping it. It seems...
If somebody doesn't utter the line, Jesus tap dancing Christ next week, I'm going to be upset.
I just hope they can explain why Humperdew's dancing is... Maybe they won't. Maybe they were supposed to accept it. But I wish they'd explain how that's all tied together. Or I guess they did explain it, how everybody's supposed to be so mesmerized by his dance that they won't notice what's going on.
Right.
And then the true believers will live. That's right. I guess they did explain it. Well, this concludes our coverage for this episode. I really don't want it to end, so I'm milking it out here as we kind of, you know, talk through the what ifs. But I guess all will be revealed in just a few short days. Any final thoughts from you, Dean, before we wrap up?
I'm like you. I think they've done a great job of leading us toward the end, but we have no idea what's going to happen at the end. And I think that's a good thing. But I mean, I know we kind of make our joke connections, but even think about how we really didn't know what was going to go on in the last episode of Legion, and I think we got a lot of stuff we didn't expect, and it was great. So hopefully Preacher pulls it off the same way.
I think they will. I have no doubt.
So the world ends next week.
Ooh, or does it?
Dun, dun, dun.
All right. So let's sign off. You want to give our Twitter handles and we'll wrap up here until next week?
Yes. Follow us at MikeTV1 on Twitter. You can find me at Rockdale_Tiger as well. If you want to let us know anything about what you're thinking with Preacher, or if you've started watching American Horror Story and you want to go ahead and get ramped up with some questions, we are going to kind of hold off on our discussions for that until after next week. But I'm sure we might be able to pitch in about a, you know, little preview next week if we can't stop talking, depending on if we can't stop talking about Preacher or not. But we will start with our American Horror Story content in a couple of weeks. We're going to try to run those a little bit different and see if we can get some more involvement and throw some questions out there for y'all as well too. So hopefully you find us and let us know what's going on and interact with us so we can interact with you. And as always, thank you for listening to us every week.
Yes, everybody, it's your last chance to share some thoughts on Preacher with us. So please, please tweet at us. Give us any musings, moments of hilarity, things you might still be confused about, things we got wrong, revelations we provided for you. Whatever it is, let us hear from you about Preacher and about other shows you'd like us to cover as well. And of course, as Dean mentioned, American Horror Story coverage is coming soon. We are hoping Steph will be able to join us for some, if not all, of that coverage that we're planning there. And then we're just a couple short weeks away from Watchmen. So we have a lot more coming your way.
Also, October 11th, it's not TV, but Breaking Bad movie, El Camino, comes out on Netflix. So,
yeah, I think we should definitely talk about that.
Yeah, we might have to have like a one-off episode for that.
And speaking of TV movies, I did go see the Downton Abbey movie over the weekend. So, you know, who knows?
If anybody
wants to tweet me about the Downton Abbey movie, I loved it. But
a lot of sword fights and dragons and stuff in that one.
Yeah, and fist dildos and people being thrown into walls and Hitler. Yeah, it's all of it.
Maggie Smith rapes like three people. Yeah,
yeah, all those.
Was Dan Stevens in it?
No, Dan Stevens' character dies in the first season.
Oh, spoiler alert. Oh, man.
Excuse me, fourth season.
Oh, okay, well.
Yeah, yeah. Matthew Crawley, the love of Mary Crawley's life. No, he died so that he could go on to do Legion.
How did he die? Consumption?
No, car accident.
I thought this took place in like the 1800s.
No, 1920s.
Big car. Yeah, I guess they had cars back then.
Yes. First cars.
The first car. They probably didn't drive very well. That's why he died. No. Oh, well.
He was taking a corner too fast.
All right. Well, RIP.
Yeah. Spoiler alert for Downton Abbey. I'm sure everybody listening is for sure.
They're like, finally, Downton Abbey talk. I've been waiting for this one.
Like, yeah. All right, everybody. We will talk to you next week for our Preacher finale. Thank you again. Goodbye.
Bye-bye.
What's the pop culture podcast that features three aging Gen Xers and one dirty Xennial? It's Radio Labyrinth, hosted by Tim Andrews, Jeff Leboff, Stephanie Swain, and Autumn Fisher. Movies, TV, podcasts, comic books, music, and a labyrinth of tales about ourselves. You'll enjoy comedy, improv, impersonations, and recommendations for the coolest stuff you can watch, listen, or read. Check out Radio Labyrinth on iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, or wherever you catch your podcasts. Check us out at RadioLabyrinthPodcast.com.